From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. According to studies, about 35% of Americans think there's no solid evidence linking human actions to global warming. More than 60% say the debate over man-made climate change still hasn't been resolved. Now, these are matters that have pretty much been settled by science, and yet they persist. So the question is why? Well, that's what the science historian Naomi Oreskes was trying to get at in her book called The Merchants of Doubt. Oreskes explains that this kind of doubt is the result of a concerted strategy to confuse the public. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Oreskes about the book, and we invite you to join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science for things like the dangers of smoking, the reason for acid rain, the causes of global warming, all of that's pretty convincing. And for the vast majority of the scientific community, these matters are pretty much settled. So why is there still a debate? Why are there still questions and doubts about it? The science historian Naomi Oreskes has traced the source of this doubt, the reason that troubling numbers of Americans are still unconvinced by facts. Her work led her to a small group of influential scientists who for decades now have been running campaigns to mislead the public and to misrepresent the work of other scientists. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had with Naomi Oreskes a few years ago about her book. It's called The Merchants of Doubt. It inspired a new documentary, and the Salt Lake Film Society is screening it starting this weekend. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. These days, Naomi Oreskes is at Harvard University, where she's a professor of the history of science and an affiliated professor of Earth and planetary sciences. She co-authored the book, Merchants of Doubt, with historian Eric Conway. I guess I wanted to begin with your role as a scientist and an historian, because I think in some ways the story is as much about the science, because it's clearly about that, as it is the history. It's about culture and ideology and those kinds of things. And your perspective as an historian must add another layer, help us understand all of these questions.
Yes, definitely. I'm a historian of science, and that means I'm interested in the development of scientific knowledge in context. So all historians of science would say that although scientists, of course, try as hard as possible to be objective, to be neutral, to be fair, to judge the data solely on its merits, the reality is that scientists don't live in a locked box room, right? They don't live in a vacuum chamber. So they are affected by politics and sociology and ideology. And so the book really is looking at that interface and looking at what happens when scientists discover things about the natural world that are uncomfortable or discomforting for other people.
Do you think, and we'll get to this as we go, do you think part of the reason that it's, I don't know if it's easy to spread doubt, but there is so much doubt and so many questions, so much skepticism on matters that are mostly settled, is it because scientists aren't great at sometimes communicating the results of what they've found? They're not great communicators? That may have something to do with it?
Yeah, definitely. In the book, Eric Conway and I talk about how there's many reasons why it's easy to spread doubt and why, in a way, it's very hard for scientists to get the message across. So one reason is definitely the scientists themselves. I mean, we all know scientists are people who often like being left alone in the laboratory. If they could, they would be in a locked box, you know. They prefer to just be left alone. So most scientists are not particularly effective communicators, and that has definitely been a problem. But in addition, scientists have discovered things that are really troubling, and none of us like bad news. So if I tell you you're in serious trouble, you know, you're dying of cancer, but someone else comes along and says, well, we don't really know, you know, or if I tell you that if you smoke cigarettes, you're going to die of cancer, but someone else comes along and says, oh, that's not true, keep on smoking, you know, don't worry about it. Most of us would rather hear the don't worry about it message.
Mm. want to ask you about what is it that got you started on all of this? What were was it a sense of frustration about how it is that, as we said, science that has pretty much been resolved, pretty much been settled in many ways, still is. I mean, what is it that got you? What was the thing that got you started in thinking about
yeah,
all of this?
Yeah, no, it wasn't frustration at all. I mean, now I'm frustrated. Yeah. Now that I've learned what I've learned over the last 5 years and written this book, I find it staggering that the scientific evidence is so overwhelming, much more than Eric and I knew when we began this project. I mean, what we were really stunned by when we started working on this was how robust the science was, how little doubt there actually was among scientists, and how long these things have been known. But we didn't start this book because of that. Like most important things in life, this book happened entirely by accident. I was working on the history of oceanography. Eric was working on the history of atmospheric sciences. And independently, we both discovered these resistance or denial campaigns. And we met at a conference. I gave a paper about some of the work I was doing. And Eric came up to me afterwards and said, you know, the same people who are denying global warming were the same people who denied the scientific evidence of the ozone hole. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. So we started digging a little more. And then we realized that there was this rather large and rather significant story to be told.
Let me ask you, because I want to start breaking down the stories that you tell in the book, but sort of the broad idea of it being organized, this—that it was a group of scientists that had a particular strategy. In fact, there were handbooks. One in particular we'll talk about for all of this. Did you feel a little queasy about that idea? I mean, this idea that it would be somehow dismissed as, you know, a great grand conspiracy theory, that it that you did actually trace, you know, a strategy, a concerted effort.
Exactly. And we were very queasy. When we realized what was going on, it was exactly what you thought. I thought, oh, no, people are going to just dismiss us as conspiracy theorists. So you'll notice that the word conspiracy never appears in the book, but we do talk about organized networks. And as you say, we do talk about strategies. And the evidence overwhelmingly showed that this was organized, that it was organized, that it was planned. As you said, that there were handbooks giving people advice about how to go about this. And what was for us the key thing that led to the book in the first place was the discovery that the same people and the same organizations and the same think tanks had been involved over and over and over again in campaigns to challenge established, well-accepted science.
We're going to get to the characters as they go, because there's some great characters, I have to say, in the book. And
yes, there are.
the Freds, which we'll talk about as we go.
Yes.
But I wanted to jump back to 1953, as you do in the book. This is December of that year. Because it seems to have, a lot of this seems to sort of trace back to that moment. And this was when the presidents of four of the country's largest tobacco companies, as you say in the book, met in this hotel in New York. And they're there to essentially figure out how to deal with the scientific evidence that had just emerged only months before that, and here it is, tobacco causes cancer. Talk about that as the starting point, because that seems to be have been a sort of pivotal moment in this story.
Exactly. Well, it was the starting point, and it actually kind of gave us chills when we discovered this. And in fact, it's giving me chills right now, even hearing you say it again, because it is really, it was almost frightening for us to discover how conscious, how deliberate this whole thing was when it began. And there is a day, as a historian, sometimes it's frustrating because, you know, in life, everything is connected to everything else, and sometimes you're never quite sure where to begin your story. But that wasn't the case here. It was clear that it was on, as you said, a fateful day in December 1953. So there had been evidence of the harms of tobacco going back to the 1930s. As many people know, the Nazis had big anti-smoking campaigns. Adolf Hitler didn't let people smoke in his presence. People got awards for quitting smoking in Nazi Germany. But a lot of that, a lot of the science behind that had been discredited by its Nazi associations. So in the 1950s, scientists, particularly in the United States and England, began to look again at the evidence and to do new experiments. And in 1953, there was a crucial experiment that took place at the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, where scientists painted the tar from cigarettes on the skin of laboratory mice, and those mice got cancers in the spots where the tar had been painted. This experiment was really viewed as a crucial experiment. It was viewed as showing a direct causal relationship, and it got a huge amount of publicity. It was written up in Reader's Digest. Reader's Digest had a headline, Cancer by the Carton. So the tobacco industry, as you can imagine, was pretty upset because there was now really definitive evidence that the product that they produced killed people. So they didn't know what to do about that. So they met, and they met at a very fancy hotel, very expensive fancy hotel in New York City. And they decided right then and there that they would challenge the scientific evidence, that they would develop a conscious strategy with the help of a public relations firm to challenge the scientific evidence, and to do it by fostering doubt, by spreading doubt, not by saying, oh, there's no evidence that that's true, because they wouldn't be able to say that with a straight face, but by saying, well, we don't really know. Mice are not people. You know, that was just one experiment. Those people are crazy, anti-smoking, Puritan Nazis. So to try to discredit the science and to try to discredit the scientists. And what we show in the book is how that strategy then grew and spread over the next five decades.
I want to talk about the particular elements of this strategy. Help us understand this idea of doubt. John Hill, the head of this big public relations firm, Hill & Knowlton, is there. And he says this, you quote him in the book, that at the end of the day, he says, scientific doubts must remain. So that was the key to the strategy then, that, as you said, not that there wasn't some evidence, but look, it's not conclusive. I mean, you see the strains of that in the conversation today about global warming. This idea that we're not sure, there's some doubt.
Exactly. And it's such a clever strategy. I mean, you talk about the characters in the book. Hill is like this evil genius, you know, right? Because it's a really genius strategy. Because, again, he doesn't have to lie. He can say doubts remain. And, of course, that is true. It's always true. And it's especially true in science, because a good scientist, in fact, always allows doubt to remain. A good scientist acknowledges that scientific knowledge is fallible, that it's possible that tomorrow we will learn some new things that will cause us to have to adjust our convictions. And in fact, that's a good thing, that a good scientist remains open-minded and is on the lookout, is alert for the possibility that maybe he or she has missed something significant along the way. So it's all true, but it's also incredibly misleading, right? Because if you have a very large volume of data that shows that this appears to be correct beyond a reasonable doubt, then at a certain point, the scientific community says, okay, to the extent that it's possible to ever say that we know anything at all in life, we know that tobacco causes cancer.
Well, this is important because you say that, you know, because you asked that question, if the science is firm, then how could they do that? I mean, how could they cause doubt? And you say this in the book, you say that it's important to understand scientific discovery is complicated. It's not an event. It's not just a set thing. It's an event, I guess.
I think we say it's not an event. It's a process.
It's
right?
a process. That's so it. Not, that's it. You're right.
Right. Thank you. That's okay. You've read the book very closely, which is great. I'm really pleased. It's great to talk to you. Right. So it's a process. It's not like there's a day on which scientists take a vote, for example, like we vote for president, and they vote and say, okay, all those who believe that tobacco causes cancer, raise your hand. It's not like that. It's a process, and it's a process by which something emerges. Scientists do work. They do a lot of different kinds of work in different places. And of course, this is the strength of science, that it is very diverse, that you have lots of different people with different political views, different religious views, men, women, blacks, whites, people in all different countries. They do all this different work. And out of this process, they generate evidence. They generate data. And over time, those data may not converge. We have scientific problems where we don't have answers. And so scientists keep working. But sometimes answers do emerge. And sometimes the evidence becomes so overwhelming that pretty much everybody working on it says, yes, this makes sense. We know what's going on here. So a consensus emerges as a kind of emergent property of the scientific community. And it's that process, this sort of emergent process, that is really crucial for people to understand, because at any given point along the way, somebody can always raise an objection. And even at the end, you can almost always find one person somewhere, somehow, who still doesn't agree, even though 99% of everybody else agrees. And that's what we see happening today with global warming, that the vast, vast majority of scientists, probably 99%, maybe more, maybe 99.5%, agree that climate change is underway, that it's happening, that it's largely caused by human activities. But, of course, there are doubts. Doubts do remain, and those doubts can be exploited. And that's what we see happening.
Well, and it begins in the 50s. And with this strategy, you say they raised these loaded questions about the data. They cherry-picked the anomalies. But another aspect of it, which is interesting and seems to be important in the way this story plays out, is one strategy, which is to appeal to journalists for balance. And it seems like that particular strategy still applies today. This is an important part of this story.
Yes, it's really crucial because if they raised doubts but nobody heard about it, then of course none of this would have had any impact. So a key part of the strategy involved journalists, and it involved appealing, as you said, to journalists' sense of fairness, objectivity, and especially balance. So they would call journalists. In fact, you may even get calls after the show,
yeah.
right? And
yeah,
this has happened.
Sure.
I've been on shows where this has happened, where people, they would call a journalist. So if a journalist did a story about tobacco in which they said the evidence is overwhelming that tobacco causes, and not just cancer, heart disease, bronchitis, emphysema, a whole host of adverse health effects, the tobacco industry spokespeople or their agents in think tanks and other organizations would actually call either the journalist himself or in many cases his editor and complain and say, that story was not balanced. You need to give us equal time for our views. And the vast majority of editors and journalists would agree to that because, in fact, they did think that they needed to be balanced. But we also show in the book that in some cases where journalists tried to resist and say, well, no, the evidence is overwhelming, we don't need to balance the story, then they would threaten to sue them under the fairness doctrine. So journalists were really in a tight spot. And so in the vast majority of cases, what we see is journalists going along with this idea that they should give these people, if not equal time, then at least quite substantial amounts of time. And we show in the book, you know, as you said, this story begins in 1953 with the definitive evidence that cigarette tar causes cancer. We show in the book as late as 1979, the New York Times, which prides itself as being a newspaper of record, was still quoting tobacco industry spokesmen claiming that we still didn't really know.
Mm. I liked the part where you talked about Edward R. Murrow feeling particularly conflicted. He fell victim,
right,
as you say, to these tactics.
I know. That's one of my favorite stories in the books. It's so heartbreaking, right? So Edward R. Murrow has the reputation of probably being the most upright journalist of the 20th century, and yet even he fell victim to these tactics. And of course, he himself was a smoker, so the other part of this story is what we referred to before. If the tobacco industry comes along and says, well, you know, we're not really sure, if you're a smoker, you know, you probably are happy to hear that message, and you'd like to hear what the tobacco industry has to say about it.
The question comes up, don't scientists who have ideas that depart from conventional science, don't they have this right to be heard, or at least don't they deserve equal time? Back to that idea. And you write, the simple answer is no, they don't, because this isn't about opinion, it's about evidence.
Exactly. So what we would say is, no, they don't deserve equal time. They might deserve time in proportion to their views. So, for example, I was asked recently if I would debate a climate skeptic, and I said no, because I think that just plays into this doubt must remain strategy. So I think that if you agree to debate, you've, in a sense, bought into this whole doubt-mongering strategy. So then the reporter came back to me and said, well, what about if we had two scientists and one skeptic? And I replied, I would come on your show if you had 99 scientists and one skeptic, because I do think, you know, fair enough, if these people would like to have their views presented. But let the audience be clear about this, that this is an extreme minority position, and it's a position that the vast majority of scientists would say is not supported by the scientific data. And that's really the crucial point. Everyone is entitled to their opinion. But as Daniel Patrick Moynihan used to like to say, you're not entitled to your own facts, right? And this is all about trying to fairly and objectively, as much as is humanly possible, evaluate the evidence, to evaluate the facts. And that's the point that gets missed when journalists insist on balance.
Naomi Oreskes, she co-authored the book Merchants of Doubt with the historian Eric Conway. We spoke with her back in 2011. There's a new documentary out based on the book. It's called Merchants of Doubt, and it's opening at the Broadway Center Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake City starting today. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had back in 2011 with the science historian Naomi Oreskes. We were talking about her book called Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. She co-wrote the book with the historian Eric Conway. There's a new documentary based on the book that's just opening in Salt Lake City this weekend. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. It's interesting that for a while the strategy kind of works, you know. I mean, the tobacco industry you talk about, they develop these ties with doctors and public health authorities and medical school faculties around the country. But then comes 1964, which is another kind of critical moment. And there's the Surgeon General report, Surgeon General at the time, Luther Terry, who releases this report about the relationship between smoking and health, cancer. And it's based on 7,000 scientific studies, testimony of hundreds of researchers and consultants, and they come to this unanimous conclusion. Here it is. Tobacco smoking causes lung cancer. And what I love about the story is you talk about how he makes the announcement in this auditorium, and he realizes it's going to be such a big deal that they lock the doors. I mean, there's all of the security related to it. You even describe it as kind of this bombshell. Talk about that.
Yes. Right. Well, it was a bombshell. And in fact, they also released the report on the weekend because they were afraid of the impact it might have on the stock market. Yeah. And I think this is a really important story because it's not just tobacco, right? We see similar things with the other stories we talk about in the book, like acid rain and the ozone hole and global warming, because a lot is at stake. And it's not just the health and safety of individuals, although that, of course, is extremely important, but there are also huge financial and economic interests at stake. There are jobs at stake. The tobacco industry used to always like to remind people of how many thousands or tens of thousands of people in the United States had employment related to the tobacco industry. And that was true, and that was a real concern. And it was always an issue if the tobacco industry were to contract, what would happen to those people who had jobs in those industries? So it wasn't wrong to be concerned about the jobs that might be lost, just as it's not wrong to be concerned about that today when we talk about global warming. But again, we can't address those concerns fairly and honestly if we're misrepresenting the science.
What did the tobacco industry do as a result of that report in 1964? Because they had to kind of refigure their strategy, shift gears in some ways.
Right. Well, they did a number of different things. I mean, one of the things they did, which we don't really talk about in the book, but other historians like Robert Proctor and Stanton Glantz have talked about, is they spent a lot of time researching the so-called safe cigarette. And of course, one of the things that other people's studies have shown is that even while they were claiming to develop safer cigarettes like low tar and nicotine cigarettes, they themselves knew, their own scientists were saying, this isn't working. There really is no such thing as a safe cigarette. But that was a big part of their strategy in the 1960s. They also tried to develop the argument that, well, okay, maybe smoking is dangerous, but if you're a grown-up, you have the right to decide for yourself, and the government doesn't have the right to tell you what to do. And of course, this is also, again, a crucial part of our story, because this argument about your rights then becomes part of the argument in these subsequent campaigns about ozone and acid rain and global warming, that the government should not be interfering in our lives. The government should not tell us what car to drive or what hairspray to use, that it's a matter of personal freedom. But of course, the crux of the problem, in a way, this is the crux of the real question in the book, the remaining question that's a legitimate and authentic question is, well, what do you do in a case where one person's individual rights endanger and damage other people or other species or the future of the planet? And so the tobacco industry made this argument for years that grown-ups could decide for themselves. That argument collapsed in the 1990s with the evidence about secondhand smoke, when the scientific evidence became clear that smoking didn't just cause cancer to the person who smoked, it also caused cancer to the person's wife who inhaled the secondhand smoke, or flight attendants, or bartenders and waiters and waitresses who were inhaling secondhand smoke. And with that evidence, then the tobacco industry really found itself in a bind, because now they couldn't make the claim that it was just your own personal choice. So we see a second round, and in the book we then have a second chapter that deals with tobacco again, where we revisit tobacco, the second round in the 1990s, where things get really ugly, and the tobacco industry launches a very unprincipled campaign against the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. They really try to demonize the EPA. And they join forces with other regulated industries to claim that the EPA is an agency that's out of control. And of course, we still hear those claims today.
Let's jump now to 1979, spring of that year, May. And this is another gathering, another group of tobacco executives. They've gotten together, and they're going to hear about this new program. And out of this story emerges one of the great characters of the book, the star of the evening, in fact, for this gathering, Frederick Seitz. And let's explain who Seitz is. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Seitz.
Yes.
Let's explain who he is. At the time, one of the country's most distinguished scientists. I mean, he was a big deal.
Exactly. So Frederick Seitz was a solid-state physicist. He had worked on the hydrogen bomb right after World War II, was one of the nation's most famous, most prominent scientists, and had risen to the highest possible level of American science, which is to be president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. He also became president in the 1970s of the Rockefeller University, America's leading biomedical research institution. And when he was at the Rockefeller University, he developed links with the tobacco industry because the tobacco industry was giving money to research institutes and medical schools and universities all around the country. So Fred Seitz had gotten to know tobacco executives, and he had a sense of gratitude and obligation to them because of all this funding that they had given the Rockefeller. So in 1979, he retired from the Rockefeller University. By this point, he was retirement age, and he went to work for the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. And this is part of the question you asked before about what else did the tobacco industry do.
Yeah.
So the other thing that they realized was that after a certain point, if tobacco industry executives said, well, we don't really know if smoking is hazardous, well, that wouldn't really be very credible if the Surgeon General had said, well, it was, just as you said a moment ago, and said it very, very clearly. So the tobacco industry developed this strategy of recruiting prominent scientists to challenge people like the Surgeon General and to say, well, maybe the Surgeon General says that, but Fred Seitz is the president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. And this was an extremely effective strategy, especially when dealing with journalists. Because imagine yourself. Imagine you are a journalist. Maybe you are just a general journalist. You don't have any particular specialty in oncology, right? And now you get a phone call from someone who says, well, you know, we have Frederick Seitz, the former president of the National Academy of Sciences, who says there's some important, another way of looking at this problem. You very likely would say, oh, that sounds like an interesting story. Let me hear what this man has to say. And so that is, of course, exactly what happened.
It's interesting to, and I think important to go to the motivation of Fred Seitz and Fred Singer, whom we'll get to in a moment. But the context for Seitz's motivation is that he harbored this huge grudge against the scientific community, and he'd become kind of unpopular, sort of controversial for his very conservative ideas. In particular, he had conservative ideas about the Vietnam War. He was a strident anti-communist. And this seemed to be motivating kind of where he was coming from. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes. Well, one of the things we tried to do in the book was to address the question of motivation, because this is a human story. It's not just about science. In fact, in a way, you could argue the science is the least of it. It's really the human part that makes it most interesting and readable. And we were really interested in this question. Well, why did these people do this? And especially, why would a scientist attack science? Why would he betray his own colleagues? In a way, it's a story of betrayal, right?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times scientists think that people are confused about an issue like global warming or acid rain or the ozone hole because it's complicated scientifically. I mean, if we talk about ozone depletion, most people don't even know what the stratosphere is, right? So obviously confusion is part of the story, but Fred Seitz knew what the stratosphere was, right? Fred Seitz knows what acids and bases are. So there was no possible plausible explanation that he was just confused. So we knew there had to be something else going on. And of course, a lot of people would assume that maybe it's money, maybe he's being corrupted by money, but he was a very wealthy, very comfortable man with a very nice lifestyle.
And a man who believed in science and technology. I mean, he was passionate about it.
Passionately believed in science and technology. So what we found reading his own letters, his own memoirs, and also in his correspondence with the other scientists in the story, who, as you said, we'll get to in a minute, there were really two things going on. He absolutely did hold a grudge. He was very resentful of fellow scientists who he thought didn't share a sufficiently pro-American position, and particularly in the 1960s. So this is a man, and all of the men in our story come out of World War II. Mm. They've all helped to win World War II by working on the Manhattan Project or the hydrogen bomb after the war or rocketry. They've helped to win World War II. They're fighting to win the Cold War. They're passionately pro-American and they're passionately anti-communist. And in the 40s and 50s, most of their colleagues shared their views. Most American scientists in the 1950s were quite conservative politically and took it for granted that the communist threat was real, significant, and dangerous. But that really changed in the 60s and 70s for a variety of reasons, mostly having to do with the Vietnam War. But Seitz never changed his views, even while his colleagues were changing theirs. So he became angry and resentful, and he really did harbor a personal grudge. And I think this is true of some of the other people in our story, too. And so this is something I think it's really important for the public to understand. If you get this one scientist who harbors a personal grudge, a personal animosity, well, the tobacco industry or the fossil fuel industry, you know, or the utility industry, they can exploit that. They can say, hey, come work for us. We'll give you a platform. We'll put you on television and radio, and you can talk about how you feel, and we'll even pay for it, and maybe we'll fly you to Bermuda and do a few other nice things for you as well. So you could see how this would be very alluring, very tempting for someone who's smart and really thinks he has something to say and really feels like his scientific colleagues are not listening. Now, add to it one other important piece, which is really crucial for the story. So the personal grudge explains Fred Seitz, and I think it explains a little bit about the other Fred in our book, too, doesn't entirely explain some of the other characters. So what do all of them have in common?
Yeah.
As you pointed out, they all have this extremely passionate anti-communist position, and they fear any kind of government control of individual rights. And so it becomes a kind of obsession with them so that they take what starts out as a, you know, a logical and fair-minded concern. I think all of us have some concerns about government control, right? We all want to make sure that our government doesn't become tyrannical. But they take it to a kind of illogical extreme where they start attacking any science that they think may lead to government regulation.
Naomi Oreskes, we spoke with her back in 2011. Along with the historian Eric Conway, she co-wrote the book Merchants of Doubt. There's a new documentary out called Merchants of Doubt. It's inspired by the book, of course. It's opening today at the Broadway Center Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake City. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had back in 2011 with the science historian Naomi Oreskes. We were talking about her book called Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. She co-wrote the book with the historian Eric Conway. There's a new documentary based on the book that's just opening in Salt Lake City this weekend. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Let's take a call. Barry is joining us in Athens, Georgia. Barry, welcome.
Hi. I'd like to compliment your guest on her really excellent exposition of the process of science. I'm a retired university professor and researcher in biology. And, of course, we've been dealing with this exact same strategy and process with evolution for many, many years. The exact same strategies vis-a-vis overstating how many people are the weight of evidence, for example, the number of scientists in favor of evolution, the status of the data, etc. And that plays on the press's desire for balance. We've even been dealing with a strategy that is actually organized. I don't know if you want to call it what do you call it? a um, We've been dealing with a strategy in which one particular organization has been actually orchestrating the anti-evolution themes over the last 10, 15 years. The Discovery Institute in Seattle has in fact even published a manifesto on their website on exactly how to topple evolution, not by presenting data of their own, but by casting doubt on evolution, by cherry-picking supposed facts, such as doubts in the fossil record and things like that. So, you know, the process of denying science and actually conspiring to defeat science for the purpose of ideology or for the purpose of profit is nothing new. This is a perfect exposition that you're doing on how this works in general in trying to fight science.
Naomi Oreskes, you want to respond to that?
Yes, that's exactly right. And in fact, when we were writing the book, sometimes Eric and I would give public lectures along the way and people would say, well, what about, you know, evolution, or what about, you know, genetically modified crops or whatever these other issues? And sometimes we would laugh and say, well, we're trying to write a book, not an encyclopedia. We easily could have written a whole second volume and possibly several more in other areas where these same strategies are being used. So you're absolutely right about that. And it's, I think that is part of the lesson we hope people will take from the book, that we've looked at a set of issues that are extremely important, all of which are really in the area of our expertise, which is earth and environmental science. But there are many other areas where this is going on today as well.
Very glad you called. Thanks very much. Here's an email from Thomas, who writes from Salt Lake City. I'm a scientist by profession. I've noticed that many Christian people don't trust science because they're preached to that science is fighting against the belief in God, especially when creationism and evolution is considered. But what Thomas wants to know, I'll sort of edit this a bit, is what the role of faith is. Now, it's not something you necessarily get in the book. You talk maybe more about ideology, but say something, if you would, about that, the role of that. Again, you couldn't get to it all, but do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I do, because I think that's an extremely important point. And I think, you know, you asked earlier whether or not scientists had maybe contributed to this problem, and I think this is an area where they have. I mean, I'm a great defender of the scientific process. I'm a great defender of what we learn about the natural world. And I personally believe that, I mean, I'm a geologist by training. I studied fossils when I was younger and rocks and minerals. Personally, I believe that when you go out in the world and you spend time in nature, you are so amazed by the wonder of nature and the universe that it makes you more likely to be spiritual and religious than if you hadn't, in my personal opinion. So I think scientists have made a big mistake here. A lot of, and I shouldn't say all scientists, but some scientists have really been hostile to religion. Some scientists have ridiculed people of faith. And some scientists have said things about scientific work that are just not true. So the fact is, many scientists are people of faith. I work all the time with scientists who are members of faith-based communities. I'm a member of a faith-based community. There's a long history of a rapprochement between science and religion. There's a long history of many great scientists who were themselves religious people. So there is no intrinsic conflict between science and religion. There have been conflicts between certain scientific conclusions and certain kinds of religious approaches, but there's a huge amount of grounds for rapprochement. So I think it's really important for scientists to be respectful of people's religious views and to say, look, when we tell you there's global warming, we're not saying that we know what the solution is. We're not saying that we know what the answer is to how to fix it. But we are saying there's a real problem here that needs to be addressed, not denied. And if you are a member of a faith-based community, I mean, this is how I personally feel about it. Why in the world would you want to destroy God's creation? We're seeing massive biodiversity declines right now because of global warming and other global climate and global environmental changes. Species are beginning to disappear. The habitats of species like walruses and polar bears are shrinking. And I think there are a lot of reasons why people of faith should be concerned about that.
Thomas, thanks very much. I want to introduce into the conversation the other Fred in this story, Fred Singer. He plays a role. He made these claims that this was during questions about acid rain in the ozone hole, and he makes these claims that stratospheric chlorine comes from mostly natural sources, that this wasn't human-caused. Humans weren't doing this. That's when he sort of emerges into the conversation. Tell us a little bit about Fred Singer, because he becomes extremely influential in raising these questions of doubt, because this will sort of get us to the question of ideology and the concerns that he has. Tell us about Fred Singer first.
So Fred Singer has a personal history that's very similar to Fred Seitz, Robert Jastrow, Bill Nierenberg, and the other people we talk about in the book. Again, he's a physicist. Again, he began his career at the end of World War II working on issues related to national security, in his case, rocketry programs. He was involved in some of the very early rocketry and satellite programs in the United States, and like the others, passionately anti-communist, takes the communist threat to be very, very severe and profound, and thinks it's essential for scientists and engineers to be deeply committed, 100% committed to fighting the Soviet threat through science and technology. So he comes at this whole issue with a similar kind of ideological approach as the others. But as you say, he becomes in some ways a kind of central figure, almost the Forrest Gump of denial, because he shows up again and again and again. And acid rain, the ozone hole, global warming, secondhand smoke, he's there, you know. And it's that pattern that for us was kind of the red flag, because, and we say this in the book, science, modern science is pretty tough. It's not that easy to be an expert in any one area, much less in four or five or six. And no one is an expert on acid rain and also the hazards of secondhand smoke, because these are just completely different areas. Yeah, yeah. They require entirely different forms of expertise. So when we see him denying the scientific evidence of the harms of secondhand smoke, and in the same breath denying the scientific evidence of the ozone hole, well, you know, then you know there's something a little fishy going on.
It's interesting that you raise this question, okay, what is Singer up to? What's really going on? And you say the answer really comes from his own writing. Something he wrote in 1989, for example, seems to reveal something very important to the way he's thinking about this and what that influenced his thinking. And he says that there are probably those, he writes, with hidden agendas of their own, not just to save the environment, but to change our economic system. So the thing that Singer's worried about then is that there's this hidden political agenda against capitalism. And that's a thread that runs through a lot of this this thinking, I guess.
Exactly. So the assertion is essentially that there actually is a conspiracy on the other side to bring down global capitalism. And various people who have been involved in challenging climate science, in addition to Fred Singer, have even accused scientists of being part of a global conspiracy to bring down capitalism. To which I say, having spent a lot of time with scientists, I mean, scientists are just not that organized, you know. So I mean, it's a really preposterous kind of claim, you know. But this is exactly it. It's this accusation that there's really a hidden agenda, that the scientists don't actually care about acid rain or the ozone hole. What they really care about is changing the economic system. So this is all just a giant and colossal fraud. And really that claim strains credulity on a lot of levels. But I think anyone who reads the book will see that on just the most basic level, the vast majority of the scientists working on these issues are just scientists doing their jobs. And many of the scientists who were involved in issues like the ozone hole, they didn't set out to discover the ozone hole. They stumbled upon it, just like we stumbled upon the story when we were doing much more academic historical work. So it really strains credulity, but it shows you where they're coming from, that there's this deep intellectual and ideological anxiety that all of this is the thin edge of a wedge that is designed to increase government control and take us down the road to communism. And sometimes these folks refer to environmentalists as watermelons, green on the outside and red on the inside. So it really shows you how they think about it. They think the whole environmental thing is just a cover story for a great big communist plot. And it really is. So it's kind of like a Manchurian candidate anxiety, that they think that there's just this massive global conspiracy, which is really a little bit of a strange conclusion, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, that seems like such a dated concept, you know, that seems like such a worn idea. But it seems, I mean, if you hear some of the conversation today in the sort of current public discourse, I mean, you hear that concept expounded daily by Glenn Beck, for example. I mean, it seems like there's a reemergence of this concept of, you know, this new world order and this fear of utopian socialism.
Well, I think that's right. And I think it's because people are afraid. And fear, of course, is a powerful tool that demagogues can exploit. So it is an extremely dated position, extremely dated anxiety. But I think one of the things we show in the book, and I think a lot of history shows, people can get stuck. You know, they can kind of get stuck in the mindset or the mind frame, mindset of the period in which they came of age. So here's a group of people who came of age during World War II and the Cold War, when this was a real issue, when it wasn't dated, when it was a real concern, and when both the United States and the Soviet Union were stockpiling enormous amounts of powerful thermonuclear weapons that could destroy the entire planet. So the conflict with the Soviet Union was real, it was serious, and it was important. But, you know, then it went away. And one of the things that's amazing about the story is that we show the first year that these folks write a report challenging the scientific evidence of global warming is right when the Cold War is coming to the end, 1989. So this, to me, really shows how stuck they were, that the Cold War ends, and you might have thought they'd be happy, that they would be proud of their own contribution to the West winning the Cold War. But instead, they find a new enemy, and that new enemy, you know, are the Reds under the beds, who are the environmentalists. So I think for them, it's actually, it doesn't make sense, but it's easy. You can see how, you can understand how they kind of got stuck in this mindset. And remember, by the time they begin doing all this anti-environmental work, they're all pretty mature. These are all men in their retirement years. So they're sort of frozen in a mindset that had worked for them for a long time. Glenn Beck, I don't know what his, you know, I don't know what his story is. It doesn't make so much sense when we go now to the present, to those of us who didn't even really grow up in the Cold War.
The fight against secondhand smoke that you write about raises this effort or strategy by Fred Singer and others. A man named Tom Hockaday is an important figure here as well, to claim that there was bad science or junk science associated with it. I wanted you to talk about that, because this idea of bad science is an important part of the strategy.
Right. So the tobacco industry invents the term junk science as a way to try to discredit science that they don't like. And so they go on this whole campaign to claim that the EPA science is bad science. The reality, of course, is that they're the ones doing bad science. They're the ones who are taking data out of context and cherry picking it. And again, we get back to this at the end of the book. It gets back to the question of understanding what good science really is. And it's not that exciting. So it's hard, you know, when we first were talking to an editor about this, we said, you know, there's no way to make this really flashy and exciting, but good science is peer-reviewed. It's science that has been scrutinized by other scientists and been subjected to open discussion and criticism. And this is really crucial, again, to understanding how science works. One of the things that scientists spend the most amount of time doing in their daily lives is going to conferences and workshops, because that's where they present their data. And what happens at those conferences and workshops? When they stand up in public and they present their data, does everybody just sit there and clap politely? No, no way. People attack them. People argue very vociferously. Scientific conferences are very vigorous places where people challenge data very aggressively, because people believe that that's how you get at the truth, that you actually have a good, healthy fight about it. And scientists, by subjecting their data to this process, have a way to find out if they are making mistakes, if they are not seeing important things. So it's very important that scientists go through peer review, that they subject their data to evaluation and scrutiny and criticism. And that's what leads in the long run to good science. What these other folks do, the tobacco industry, the ideologues, the think tanks, they write reports that are not subject to peer review. They don't submit them to conventional scientific journals. They publish their own separate papers. We call it a scientific Potemkin village, because they create this facade, this appearance of science. They write reports that sound scientific, and they have tables and graphs, but in most cases, they haven't been peer-reviewed. They haven't been presented at national meetings. They have not been subject to the kind of scrutiny and criticism that real science allows itself to be subject to.
You write a bit about also the influence of how much easier it is to impose this question of doubt in the internet age, a place, you know, where you've got all of this. It's a home of unfiltered, unsubstantiated information. Disinformation, you say in the book, never dies. So that's must have a profound influence on all of this.
It is. It's a real problem, and it's one that we don't propose, you know, we don't pretend to have a solution to. But it's certainly the case that the internet has made it that much easier to spread these ridiculous, faulty claims. And I experience this all the time in my own work, because when I give public lectures, almost invariably there'll be someone in the audience who will say, well, I read on the internet XYZ, you know, what about that? And sometimes the claims are reasonable enough, and you can explain why those claims are not true, even though they're plausible. Sometimes they're just completely ridiculous. So just the other day, I did a radio show where the host said he got something from a listener where they said that they thought, they had read on the internet, that global warming was caused by hidden underwater volcanoes that were heating the ocean. Well, you know, I started this project as a historian of oceanography. I know a little something about the U.S. Navy's work. And one of the things we know is that the U.S. Navy has done incredibly comprehensive mapping of the seafloor since since about the end of World War II. The U.S. Navy knows what's down there. And it's not plausible that there are massive numbers of secret volcanoes heating up the ocean. So it kind of shows the lengths to which people are now going to deny the scientific evidence because of whatever set of anxieties, fears, worries, or ideologies are motivating them. So they're just searching out alternatives, and they can easily find those alternatives on the internet.
We're about out of time. Let me ask you this finally, about a minute and a half left. In the end, you talk about how, in some ways, this is about trust, which you argue we have to focus our trust. It has to be particular. And in some ways, we kind of have to change our view of science or our understanding about just what scientific knowledge is and how it works.
Right. So that is what we say. And so, again, it's a subtle argument. It's not something that's easily reduced to a soundbite. But it does involve two crucial things. One is the one we've already discussed. Understanding science is a process.
Yeah.
Understanding that scientific discovery is not an event. It's something that takes place over many decades. And so, you know, this is slightly self-serving, but it's one of the reasons why I think history is so important. When I lecture on this subject and I talk to people about Roger Revelle and the work that was done back in the 1950s and how people actually predicted, scientists predicted almost all of the changes that are taking place now were predicted by scientists in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Many people are really surprised to learn that because they don't realize that the science goes back that far. So understanding it as a process and understanding that the amount of time put into this is a relevant part of the story, I think that's really important. And the other thing, as you said, at some level, we do have to trust our experts because they're the people we hire to do this work.
Naomi Oreskes. We spoke with her back in 2011 about her book, Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. A new documentary is out that is inspired by the book. It's called Merchants of Doubt. It's opening tonight at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.